flying splinters. Thetis stood in the doorway, hot as living flame. Her divinity swept over us all, singeing our eyes, blackening the broken edges of the door. I could feel it pulling at my bones, sucking at the blood in my veins as if it would drink me. I cowered, as men were made to do. Odysseus's dark beard was dusted with fine debris from the door's ruin. He stood. "Greetings, Thetis." Her gaze went to him as a snake's to her prey, and her skin glowed. The air around Odysseus seemed to tremble slightly, as if with heat or a breeze. Diomedes, on the ground, edged away. I closed my eyes so I would not have to see the explosion. A silence, into which at last I opened my eyes. Odysseus stood unharmed. Thetis's fists were strangling themselves white. It no longer burned to look at her. "The grey-eyed maiden has ever been kind to me," Odysseus said, almost apologetically. "She knows why I am here. She blesses and guards my purpose." It was as if I had missed a step of their conversation. I struggled now to follow the grey-eyed maiden, goddess of war and its arts. She was said to prize cleverness above all.
"Athena has no child to lose."
The words grated from Thetis's throat, hung in the air. Odysseus did not try to answer, only turned to Achilles. "Ask her," he said. "Ask your mother what she knows." Achilles swallowed, loud in the silent chamber. He met his mother's black eyes.
"Is it true? What he says?"
The last of her fire was gone, only marble remained.
"It is true, but there is more, and worse that he has not said."
The words came tonelessly, as a statue would speak them.
"If you go to Troy, you will never return. You will die a young man there."
Achilles' face went pale.
"Is it certain?"
This is what all mortals ask first in disbelief, shock, fear. Is there no exception for me?
"It is certain."
If he had looked at me then, I would have broken. I would have begun to weep and never stopped. But his eyes were fixed on his mother. "What should I do?" he whispered. The slightest tremor over the still water of her face.
"Do not ask me to choose," she said,
and vanished. I cannot remember what we said to the two men, how we left them, or how we came to our room. I remember his face, skin drawn tightly over his cheeks, the dulled pallor of his brow. His shoulders, usually so straight and fine, seemed fallen. Grief swelled inside me, choking me. His death. I felt as if I was dying just to think of it, plummeting through a blind black sky. "You must not go." I almost said it a thousand times. Instead, I held his hands fast between mine. They were cold and very still.
"I do not think I could bear it," he said at last.
His eyes were closed as if against horrors. I knew he spoke not of his death, but of the nightmare Odysseus had spun, the loss of his brilliance, the withering of his grace. I had seen the joy he took in his own skill, the roaring vitality that was always just beneath the surface. Who was he, if not miraculous and radiant? Who was he, if not destined for fame? "I would not care," I said. The words scrabbled from my mouth. "Whatever you became, it would not matter to me. We would be together."
"I know," he said quietly, but did not look at me.
He knew, but it was not enough. The sorrow was so large, it threatened to tear through my skin. When he died, all things swift and beautiful and bright would be buried with him. I opened my mouth, but it was too late.
"I will go," he said. "I will go to Troy."
The rosy gleam of his lip, the fevered green of his eyes. There was not a line anywhere on his face, nothing creased or graying, all crisp. He was spring, golden and bright. Envious death would drink his blood and grow young again. He was watching me, his eyes as deep as earth. "Will you come with me?" he asked. The never-ending ache of love and sorrow. Perhaps in some other life I could have refused, could have torn my hair and screamed and made him face his choice alone. But not in this one. He would sail to Troy, and I would follow, even into death. "Yes," I whispered. "Yes." Relief broke in his face, and he reached for me. I let him hold me, let him press us length to length, so close that nothing might fit between us. Tears came and fell. Above us the constellations spun and the moon paced her weary course. We lay stricken and sleepless as the hours passed. When dawn came, he rose stiffly. "I must go tell my mother," he said. He was pale and his eyes were shadowed. He looked older already. Panic rose in me. "Don't go," I wanted to say, but he drew on a tunic and was gone. I lay back and tried not to think of the minutes passing. Just yesterday, we had had a wealth of them. Now each was a drop of heart's blood lost. The room turned grey, then white. The bed felt cold without him, and too large. I heard no sounds, and the stillness frightened me. It is like a tomb. I rose and rubbed my limbs, slapped them awake, trying to ward off a rising hysteria. This is what it will be every day without him. I felt a wild-eyed tightness in my chest, like a scream, every day without him. I left the palace, desperate to shut out thought. I came to the cliffs, Skyros's great rocks that beetled over the sea and began to climb. The winds tugged at me, and the stones were slimy with spray, but the strain and danger steadied me. I arrowed upwards, towards the most treacherous peak, where before I would have been too fearful to go. My hands were cut almost to blood by jagged shards of rock. My feet left stains where they stepped. The pain was welcome, ordinary and clean. So easy to bear it was laughable. I reached the summit, a careless heap of boulders at the cliff's edge, and stood. An idea had come to me as I climbed, fierce and reckless as I felt. "Thetis!" I screamed it into the snatching wind, my face towards the sea. "Thetis!" The sun was high now. Their meeting had ended long ago. I drew a third breath.
"Do not speak my name again."
I whirled to face her and lost my balance. The rocks jumbled under my feet, and the wind tore at me. I grabbed at an outcrop, steadied myself. I looked up. Her skin was paler even than usual, the first winter's ice. Her lips were drawn back to show her teeth.
"You are a fool," she said. "Get down. Your half-wit death will not save him."
I was not so fearless as I thought. I flinched from the malice in her face, but I forced myself to speak, to ask the thing I had to know of her. "How much longer will he live?" She made a noise in her throat, like the bark of a seal. It took me a moment to understand that it was laughter.
"Why? Would you prepare yourself for it? Try to stop it?"
Contempt spilled across her face. "Yes," I answered, "if I can." The sound again. "Please," I knelt. "Please tell me." Perhaps it was because I knelt. The sound ceased, and she considered me a moment.
"Hector's death will be first," she said. "This is all I am given to know."
"Hector, thank you," I said. Her eyes narrowed and her voice hissed like water poured on coals.
"Do not presume to thank me. I have come for another reason."
I waited. Her face was white as splintered bone.
"It will not be so easy as he thinks. The fates promise fame, but how much? He will need to guard his honor carefully. He is too trusting. The men of Greece," she spat the words, "are dogs over a bone. They will not simply give up preeminence to another. I will do what I can. And you?
Her eyes flickered over my long arms and skinny knees.
You will not disgrace him. Do you understand?
Do you understand? Yes, I said, and I did. His fame must be worth the life he'd paid for it. The faintest breath of air touched her dress's hem, and I knew she was about to leave, to vanish back to the caves of the sea. Something made me bold. Is Hector a skilled soldier?
He is the best, she answered. But for my son.
Her gaze flickered to the right where the cliff dropped away.
He is coming, she said.
Achilles crested the rise and came to where I sat. He looked at my face and my bloodied skin. I heard you talking, he said. It was your mother, I said. He knelt and took my foot in his lap. Gently, he picked the fragments of rock from the wounds, brushing off dirt and chalky dust. He tore a strip from his tunic's hem and pressed it tight to stanch the blood. My hand closed over his. You must not kill Hector, I said. He looked up, his beautiful face framed by the gold of his hair. My mother told you the rest of the prophecy. She did. And you think that no one but me can kill Hector? Yes, I said. And you think to steal time from the fates? Yes. Ah. A sly smile spread across his face. He had always loved defiance. Well, why should I kill him? He's done nothing to me. For the first time then, I felt a kind of hope. We left that afternoon. There was no reason to linger. Ever dutiful to custom, Lycomedes came to bid us farewell. The three of us stood together stiffly. Odysseus and Diomedes had gone ahead to the ship. They would escort us back to Thyre, where Achilles would muster his own troops. There was one more thing to be done here, and I knew Achilles did not wish to do it. Lycomedes, my mother has asked me to convey her desires to you. The faintest tremor crossed the old man's face, but he met his son-in-law's gaze.
It is about the child, he said.
It is.
And what does she wish?
The king asked wearily.
She wishes to raise him herself. She?
Achilles faltered before the look on the old man's face.
The child will be a boy, she says. When he is weaned, she will claim him.
Silence. Then Lycomedes closed his eyes. I knew he was thinking of his daughter, arms empty of both husband and child.
I wish you had never come, he said.
I'm sorry, Achilles said.
Leave me,
the old king whispered. We obeyed. The ship we sailed on was Yar, tightly made and well manned. The crew moved with a competent fleetness, the ropes gleamed with new fibers, and the masts seemed fresh as living trees. The prow piece was a beauty, the finest I had ever seen, a woman, tall with dark hair and eyes, her hands clasped in front of her as if in contemplation. She was beautiful, but quietly so, an elegant jaw, an upswept hair showing a slender neck. She had been lovingly painted, each darkness or lightness perfectly rendered.
You are admiring my wife, I see.
Odysseus joined us at the railing, leaning on muscular forearms.
She refused at first, wouldn't let the artist near her. I had to have him follow her in secret. I think it turned out rather well, actually.
A marriage for love, rare as cedars from the east. It almost made me want to like him, but I had seen his smiles too often now. Politely, Achilles asked,
What is her name?
Penelope, he said. Is the ship new? I asked. If he wanted to speak of his wife, I wanted to speak of something else.
Very. Every last timber of it, from the best wood that Ithaca has.
He slapped the railing with his large palm as one might the flank of a horse.
Bragging about your new ship again.
Diomedes had joined us, His hair was lashed back with a strip of leather, and it made his face look sharper even than usual.
I am.
Diomedes spat into the water.
The king of Argos is unusually eloquent today, Odysseus commented.
Achilles had not seen their game before as I had. His eyes went back and forth between the two men, a small smile curled at the corner of his mouth.
Tell me, Odysseus continued, do you think such quick wit comes from your father having eaten that man's brains?
What?
Achilles' mouth hung open.
Oh, you don't know the tale of mighty Tydeus, king of Argos, eater of brains?
I've heard of him, but not about the brains.
I was thinking of having the scene painted on our plates, Diomedes said.
In the hall, I had taken Diomedes for Odysseus's dog, but there was a keenness that hummed between the two men, a pleasure in their sparring that could come only from equals. I remembered that Diomedes was rumored to be a favorite of Athena as well. Odysseus made a face.
Remind me not to dine in Argos any time soon.
Diomedes laughed. It was not a pleasant sound. The kings were inclined to talk and lingered by the rail with us. They passed stories back and forth of other sea voyages, of wars, of contests won in games long past. Achilles was an eager audience, with question after question.
Where did you get this?
He was pointing to the scar on Odysseus's leg.
Ah, Odysseus rubbed his hands together. That is a tale worth telling.
Though I should speak to the captain first.
He gestured to the sun, hanging ripe and low over the horizon.
We'll need to stop soon for camp.
I'll go.
Diomedes stood from where he leaned against the rail.
I've heard this one almost as many times as that sickening bed story.
Your loss,
Odysseus called after him.
Don't mind him. His wife's a hellhound bitch, and that would sour anyone's temper. Now, my wife...
I swear,
Diomedes' voice carried back up the length of the ship.
If you finish that sentence, I will throw you over the side and you can swim to Troy.
See?
Odysseus shook his head. Sour. Achilles laughed, delighted by them both. He seemed to have forgiven their part in his unmasking, and all that came after.
Now, what was I saying?
The scar,
Achilles said eagerly.
Yes, the scar. When I was 13.
I watched him hang on the other man's words. He is too trusting. But I would not be the raven on his shoulder all the time, predicting gloom. The sun slid lower in the sky, and we drew close to the dark shadow of land where we would make camp. The ship found the harbor, and the sailors drew her up on the shore for the night. Supplies were unloaded, food and bedding and tents for the princes. We stood by the campsite that had been laid for us, a small fire and pavilion.
Is all well here?
Odysseus had come to stand with us.
Very well,
Achilles said. He smiled, his easy smile. His honest one.
Thank you.
Odysseus smiled in return, teeth white against his dark beard.
Excellent. One tent's enough, I hope. I've heard that you prefer to share. Rooms and bedrolls both, they say.
Heat and shock rushed through my face. Beside me, I heard Achilles' breath stop.
Come now, there's no need for shame. It's a common enough thing among boys.
He scratched his jaw, contemplated.
Though you're not really boys any longer.
How old are you?
It's not true, I said. The blood in my face fired my voice. It rang loudly down the beach. Odysseus raised an eyebrow.
True is what men believe, and they believe this of you.
But perhaps they are mistaken. If the rumor concerns you, then leave it behind when you sail to war.
Achilles' voice was tight and angry.
It is no business of yours, Prince of Ithaca.
Odysseus held up his hands.
My apologies if I have offended. I merely came to wish you both good night and ensure that all was satisfactory.
Prince Achilles? Patroclus?
He inclined his head and turned back to his own tent. Inside the tent there was quietness between us. I had wondered when this would come. As Odysseus said, many boys took each other for lovers, but such things were given up as they grew older, unless it was with slaves or hired boys. Our men liked conquest. They did not trust a man who was conquered himself. Do not disgrace him, the goddess had said, and this is some of what she had meant. Perhaps he is right, I said. Achilles' head came up, frowning.
You do not think that?
I do not mean... I twisted my fingers. I would still be with you, but I could sleep outside, so it would not be so obvious. I do not need to attend your councils, I...
No. The Thians will not care, and the others can talk all they like. I will still be Aristos Achaion.
Best of the Greeks. Your honor could be darkened by it.
Then it is darkened. His jaw shot forward, stubborn. They are fools if they let my glory rise or fall on this.
But Odysseus... His eyes, green as spring leaves, met mine.
Patroclus, I have given enough to them. I will not give them this.
After that, there was nothing more to say. The next day, with the southern wind caught in our sail, we found Odysseus by the prow.
Prince of Ithaca, Achilles said.
His voice was formal, though none of the boyish smiles from the day before.
I wish to hear you speak of Agamemnon and the other kings. I would know the men I am to join, and the princes I am to fight.
Very well, Prince Achilles. If Odysseus noticed a change, he did not comment on it. He led us to the benches at the base of the mast below the big-bellied sail. Now, where to begin? Almost absently, he rubbed the scar on his leg. It was starker in daylight, hairless and puckered.
There is Menelaus, whose wife we go to retrieve. After Helen picked him for her husband, Patroclus can tell you about that, he became king of Sparta. He is known as a good man, fearless in battle and well-liked in the world. Many kings have rallied to his cause, and not just those who are bound to their oaths.
Such as? Achilles asked. Odysseus counted them off on his large farmer's hands.
Meriones, Idomeneus, Philoctetes, Ajax, both Ajaxes, larger and lesser.
One was the man I remembered from Tyndareus's hall, a huge man with a shield. The other I did not know.
Old King Nestor of Pylos will be there as well.
I'd heard the name. He had sailed with Jason in his youth to find the Golden Fleece. He was long past his fighting days now, but brought his sons to war and his council too. Achilles' face was intent, his eyes dark.
And the Trojans?
Priam, of course, king of Troy.
The man is said to have 50 sons, all raised with a sword in their hands.
50 sons?
And 50 daughters. He's known to be pious and much loved by the gods. His sons are famous in their own right. Paris, of course, beloved of the goddess Aphrodite, and much noted for his beauty. Even the youngest, who's barely 10, is supposed to be ferocious. Troilus, I think.
They have a god-born cousin who fights for them, too. Aeneas, his name is, a child of Aphrodite herself.
What about Hector?
Achilles' eyes never left Odysseus.
Priam's older son and heir, favorite of the god Apollo, Troy's mightiest defender.
What does he look like?
Odysseus shrugged. I don't know. They say he is large, but that is said of most heroes. You'll meet him before I do, so you'll have to tell me.
Achilles narrowed his eyes. Why do you say that?
Odysseus made a wry face.
As I am sure Diomedes will agree, I am a competent soldier, but no more. My talents lie elsewhere. If I were to meet Hector in battle, I would not be bringing back news of him. You, of course, are a different matter. You will win the greatest fame from his death.
My skin went cold.
Perhaps I would, but I see no reason to kill him, Achilles answered coolly. He's done nothing to me.
Odysseus chuckled, as if a joke had been made.
If every soldier killed only those who'd personally offended him, Pylades, we'd have no wars at all.
He lifted an eyebrow.
Though maybe it's not such a bad idea.
In that world, perhaps I'd be Aristo Sakion instead of you. Achilles did not answer. He had turned to look over the ship's side at the waves beyond. The light fell upon his cheek, lit it to glowing.
You have told me nothing of Agamemnon, he said.
Yes, our mighty king of Mycenae. Odysseus leaned back again, proud scion of the house of Atreus. His great-grandfather, Tantalus, was a son of Zeus. Surely you've heard his story. All knew of Tantalus's eternal torment. To punish his contempt for their powers, the gods had thrown him into the deepest pit of the underworld. There, they afflicted the king with perpetual thirst and hunger, while food and drink sat just out of his reach.
I've heard of him, but I never knew what his crime was, Achilles said.
Well, in the days of King Tantalus, all our kingdoms were the same size, and the kings were at peace. But Tantalus grew dissatisfied with his portion, and began to take his neighbor's lands by force. His holdings doubled, then doubled again, but still Tantalus was not satisfied. His success had made him proud, and having bested all men who came before him, he sought next to best the gods themselves, not with weapons, for no man may match the gods in battle, but in trickery. He wished to prove that the gods do not know all, as they say they do. So he called his son to him, Pelops, and asked him if he wanted to help his father. Of course, Pelops said. His father smiled and drew his sword. With a single blow, he slit his son's throat clean across. He carved the body into careful pieces and spitted them over the fire. My stomach heaved at the thought of the iron skewer through the boy's dead flesh. When the boy was cooked, Tantalus called to his father Zeus on Olympus. Father, he said, I have prepared a feast to honor you and all your kin. Hurry, for the meat is tender still, and fresh. The gods love such feasting, and came quickly to Tantalus's hall. But when they arrived, the smell of the cooking meat, normally so dear, seemed to choke them. At once, Zeus knew what had been done. He seized Tantalus by the legs and threw him into Tartarus to suffer his eternal punishment. The sky was bright, and the wind brisk, but in the spell of Odysseus's story I felt that we were by a fireside, with night pressing all around. Zeus then drew the pieces of the boy back together, and breathed a second life into him. Pelops, though only a boy, became king of Mycenae. He was a good king, distinguished in piety and wisdom, yet many miseries afflicted his reign. Some said that the gods had cursed Tantalus's line, condemning them all to violence and disaster. Pelops' sons, Atreus and Thyestes, were born with their grandfather's ambition, and their crimes were dark and bloody as his had been. A daughter raped by her father, a son cooked and eaten, all in their bitter rivalry for the throne. It is only now, by the virtue of Agamemnon and Menelaus, that their family fortune has begun to change. The days of civil war are gone, and Mycenae prospers under Agamemnon's upright rule. He has won just renown for his skill with a spear and the firmness of his leadership. We are fortunate to have him as our general. I had thought Achilles was no longer listening, but he turned now, frowning.
We are each generals.
Of course, Odysseus agreed. But we are all going to fight the same enemy, are we not? 2 dozen generals on one battlefield will be chaos and defeat. He offered a grin. You know how well we all get along, we'd probably end up killing each other instead of the Trojans. Success in such a war as this comes only through men sewn to a single purpose, funneled to a single spear thrust, rather than 1,000 needle pricks. You lead the Thians, and I the Ithacans, but there must be someone who uses us each to our abilities. He tipped a gracious hand towards Achilles. However great they may be. Achilles ignored the compliment. The setting sun cut shadows into his face. His eyes were flat and hard.
I come of my free will, Prince of Ithaca. I will take Agamemnon's counsel, but not his orders. I would have you understand this.
Odysseus shook his head. God save us from ourselves. Not even in battle yet and already worrying over honors.
I am not...
Odysseus waved a hand. Believe me, Agamemnon understands your great worth to his cause. It was he who first wished you to come. You will be welcome to our army with all the pomp you could desire. It was not what Achilles had meant exactly, but it was close enough. I was glad when the lookout shouted landfall up ahead. That evening, when we had set aside our dinners, Achilles lay back on the bed.
What do you think of these men we will meet?
I don't know. I'm glad Diomedes is gone, at least. Me too. We had let the king off at Euboea's northern tip to wait for his army from Argos. I do not trust them.
I suppose we'll know soon enough what they are like, he said.
We were silent a moment, thinking of that. Outside we could hear the beginnings of rain, soft, barely sounding on the tent roof.
Odysseus said it would storm tonight.
An Aegean storm, quickly here and quickly gone. Our boat was safely beached and tomorrow would be clear again. Achilles was looking at me.
Your hair never quite lies flat here.
He touched my head just behind my ear.
I don't think I've ever told you how I like it.
My scalp prickled where his fingers had been.
You haven't, I said.
I should have. His hand drifted down to the V at the base of my throat, drew softly across the pulse.
What about this? Have I told you what I think of this? Just here?
No, I said.
This, surely then.
His hand moved across the muscles of my chest, my skin warmed beneath it.
Have I told you of this?
That you have told me. My breath caught a little as I spoke.
And what of this?
His hand lingered over my hips, drew down the line of my thigh.
Have I spoken of it?
You have.
And this? Surely I would not have forgotten this.
His cat's smile.
Tell me I did not.
You did not.
There is this, too.
His hand was ceaseless now.
I know I have told you of this.
I closed my eyes. Tell me again, I said. Later, Achilles sleeps next to me.
Odysseus's storm has come, and the coarse fabric of the tent wall trembles with its force.
I hear the stinging slap, over and over, of waves reproaching the shore. He stirs, and the air stirs with him, bearing the musk-sweet smell of his body. I think, this is what I will miss. I think, I will kill myself rather than miss it. I think, how long do we have? Chapter 16. We arrived in Phthia the next day. The sun was just over the meridian, and Achilles and I stood looking at the rail.
Do you see that?
What? As always, his eyes were sharper than mine.
The shore. It looks strange.
As we drew closer, we saw why. It was thick with people, jostling impatiently, craning their necks towards us. And the sound. At first it seemed to come from the waves, or the ship as it cut them, a rushing roar. But it grew louder with each stroke of our oars, until we understood that it was voices, then words. Over and over it came. Prince Achilles, Aristos Achaean. As our ship touched the beach, hundreds of hands threw themselves into the air, and hundreds of throats opened in a cheer. All other noises, the wood of the gangplank banging down on rock, the sailors' commands, were lost to it. We stared in shock. It was that moment, perhaps, that our lives changed. Not before in Skyros, nor before that still on Pelion, but here, as we began to understand the grandness, now and always, that would follow him wherever he went. He had chosen to become a legend, and this was the beginning. He hesitated, and I touched my hand to his, where the crowd could not see it.
Go,
I urged him. They are waiting for you.
Achilles stepped forward onto the gangplank, his arm lifted in greeting,
and the crowd screamed itself hoarse. I half feared they would swarm onto the ship, but soldiers pushed forward and lined the gangway, making a path straight through the crush. Achilles turned back to me, said something. I could not hear it, but I understood. Come with me. I nodded, and we began to walk. On either side of us, the crowd surged against the soldiers' barrier. At the aisle's end was Peleus, waiting for us. His face was wet, and he made no attempt to wipe aside the tears. He drew Achilles to him, held him long before he let him go.
Our prince has returned!
His voice was deeper than I remembered, resonant and carrying far over the noise of the crowd. They quieted to hear the words of their king.
Before you all, I offer welcome to my most beloved son, sole heir to my kingdom. He will lead you to Troy in glory. He will return home in triumph.
Even there beneath the bright sun, I felt my skin go cold. He will not come home at all. But Peleus did not know this, yet.
He is a man grown, and God born. Aristos, Achaean.
There was no time to think of it now. The soldiers were beating on their shields with their spears, the women screamed, the men howled. I caught sight of Achilles' face. The look on it was stunned, but not displeased. He was standing differently, I noticed, shoulders back and legs braced. He looked older somehow, taller even. He leaned over to say something in his father's ear, but I could not hear what he said. A chariot was waiting. We stepped into it and watched the crowd stream behind us up the beach. Inside the palace, attendants and servants buzzed around us. We were given a moment to eat and drink what was pressed into our hands. Then we were led to the palace courtyard, where 2,500 men waited for us. At our approach, they lifted their square shields, shining like carapace, in salute to their new general. This, out of all of it, was perhaps the strangest, that he was their commander now. He would be expected to know them all, their names and armor and stories. He no longer belongs to me alone. If he was nervous, even I could not tell. I watched as he greeted them, spoke ringing words that made them stand up straighter. They grinned, loving every inch of their miraculous prince, his gleaming hair, his deadly hands, his nimble feet. They leaned towards him like flowers to the sun, drinking in his luster. It was as Odysseus had said. He had light enough to make heroes of them all. We were never alone. Achilles was always needed for something. His eye on draft sheets and figures, his advice on food supplies and levy lists. Phoenix, his father's old counselor, would be accompanying us. But there were still 1,000 questions for Achilles to answer. How many? How much? Who will be your captains? He did what he could, then announced,
I defer all the rest of such matters to the experience of Phoenix.
I heard a servant girl sigh behind me, handsome and gracious both. He knew that I had little to do here. His face, when he turned to me, was increasingly apologetic. He was always sure to place the tablets where I could see them too, to ask my opinion, but I did not make it easy for him, standing in the back, listless and silent. Even there I could not escape. Through every window came the constant clatter of soldiers, bragging and drilling and sharpening their spears. The Myrmidons, they had begun calling themselves, Ant-Men, an old nickname of honor. Another thing Achilles had had to explain to me, the legend of Zeus creating the first Thians from ants. I watched them marching, rank on cheerful rank. I saw them dreaming of the plunder they would bring home and the triumph. There was no such dream for us. I began to slip away. I would find a reason to linger behind as the attendants ushered him forward, an itch or a loose strap of my shoe. Oblivious, they hurried on, turned a corner, and left me suddenly, blessedly alone. I took the twisting corridors I had learned so many years ago and came gratefully to our empty room. There, I lay on the cool stone of the floor and closed my eyes. I could not stop imagining how it would end. Spear tip or sword point, or smashed by a chariot. The rushing, unending blood of his heart. One night, in the second week, as we lay half-drowsing, I asked him, "How will you tell your father about the prophecy?" The words were loud in the silence of midnight. For a moment he was still. Then he said, "I do not think I will." "Never?" He shook his head, just the barest shadow. "There is nothing he can do. It would only bring him grief." "What about your mother? Won't she tell him?" "No," he said. "It was one of the things I asked her to promise me, that last day on Skyros." I frowned. He had not told me this before. What were the other things? I saw him hesitate, but we did not lie to each other. We never had. "I asked her to protect you," he said. "After." I stared at him dry-mouthed. "What did she say?" Another silence. Then, so quietly I could imagine the dull red shame of his cheeks, he answered, "She said no." Later, when he slept, and I lay wakeful and watching under the stars, I thought of this. Knowing that he had asked warmed me. It chased away some of the coldness of the days here in the palace, when he was wanted every moment and I was not. As for the goddess's answer, I did not care. I would have no need of her. I did not plan to live after he was gone. 6 weeks passed, the 6 weeks that it took to organize soldiers, to equip a fleet, to pack up food and clothing to last the length of the war. A year, perhaps, or two. Sieges were always long. Peleus insisted that Achilles take only the best. He paid for a small fortune in armor, more than 6 men would need. There were hammered bronze breastplates, graven with lions and a rising phoenix, stiff leather greaves with gold bands, horsehair plumed helms, a silver-forged sword, dozens of spearheads, and 2 light-wheeled chariots. With this came a 4-horse team, including the pair given to Peleus by the gods at his wedding. Xanthos and Balios they were called, Golden and Apple, and their eyes rolled white with impatience whenever they were not free to run. He also gave us a charioteer, a boy younger than we were, but sturdily built and said to be skilled with headstrong horses. Automedon, his name was. Finally, last of all, a long spear, ash sapling peeled of bark and polished until it glowed like grey flame. "From Chiron," Peleus said, handing it to his son. We bent over it, our fingers trailing its surface as if to catch the centaur's lingering presence. Such a fine gift would have taken weeks of Chiron's deft shaping. He must have begun it almost the day that we left. Did he know, or only guess at Achilles' destiny? As he lay alone in his rose-colored cave, had some glimmer of prophecy come to him? Perhaps he simply assumed, a bitterness of habit, of boy after boy trained for music and medicine, and unleashed for murder. Yet this beautiful spear had been fashioned not in bitterness, but love. Its shape would fit no one's hand but Achilles, and its heft could suit no one's strength but his. And though the point was keen and deadly, the wood itself slipped under our fingers like the slender oiled strut of a lyre. At last the day for our departure came. Our ship was a beauty, finer even than Odysseus's. Sleek and slim as a knife point, meant to cut the sea. It rode low in the water, heavy with stores of food and supplies. And that was only the flagship. Beside it, 49 others, a city of wood, rolled gently in the waters of Thyre's harbour. Their bright prow pieces were a bestiary of animals and nymphs and creatures half in between, and their masts stood as tall as the trees they had been. At the front of each of these ships, one of our new minted captains stood at attention, saluting as we walked up the ramp to our vessel. Achilles went first, his purple cloak stirring in the breeze from the sea, then Phoenix, and me with a new cloak of my own, holding the old man's arm to steady his steps. The people cheered for us and for our soldiers, filing on to their own ships. All around us, final promises were shouted, of glory, of the gold that would be stripped and brought home from Priam's rich city. Peleus stood at the shore's edge, one hand raised in farewell. True to his word, Achilles had not told him of the prophecy, merely hugged him tightly, as if to soak the old man into his skin. I had embraced him too, those thin, wiry limbs. I thought, this is what Achilles will feel like when he is old. And then I remembered, he will never be old. The ship's boards were still sticky with new resin. We leaned over the railing to wave our last farewell, the sun-warm wood pressed against our bellies. The sailors heaved up the anchor, square and chalky with barnacles, and loosened the sails. Then they took their seats at the oars that fringed the boat like eyelashes, waiting for the count. The drums began to beat, and the oars lifted and fell, taking us to Troy. Chapter 17. But first, to Aulis. Aulis, a jutting finger of land with enough shoreline to beach all our ships at once. Agamemnon had wanted his mighty force assembled in a single place before it sailed. A symbol, perhaps, the visible power of Greece offended. After 5 days churning through the rough waters of the Euboean coast, we came around the last hitch of the winding strait, and Aulis was there. It appeared all at once, as if a veil had been yanked off. Shoreline thick with vessels in every size and color and shape, its beach covered in a shifting carpet of thousands upon thousands of men. Beyond them, the canvas tops of tents stretched out to the horizon, bright pennants marking the king's pavilions. Our men strove at their oars, guiding us towards the last empty place on the crowded shore, big enough for our whole fleet. Anchors dropped from 50 sterns. Horns blew. The myrmidons from the other ships were already wading ashore. They stood now at the water's edge, surrounding us, white tunics billowing. At a signal we could not see, they began to chant their prince's name, 2,500 men speaking as one, Achilles. All along the shore, heads turned, Spartans, Argives, Mycenaeans, and all the rest. The news went rippling through them, passing one to another. Achilles is here. As the sailors lowered the gangway, we watched them gather, kings and conscripts both. I could not see the princely faces from the distance, but I recognized the pennants that their squires carried before them, the yellow banner of Odysseus, the blue of Diomedes, and then the brightest, the biggest, a lion on purple, the symbol of Agamemnon and Mycenae. Achilles looked to me, drew in a breath. The screaming crowd at Thyre was nothing compared to this, but he was ready. I saw it in the way he lifted his chest, in the fierce green of his eyes. He walked to the gangway and stood at its top. The Myrmidons kept up their shouts, and they were not alone now. Others in the crowd had joined them. A broad-chested Myrmidon captain cupped his hands around his mouth. "Prince Achilles, son of King Peleus and the goddess Thetis! Aristo, Sarcaion!" As if in answer the air changed. Bright sunlight broke and poured over Achilles, went rolling down his hair and back and skin, turning him to gold. He seemed suddenly larger, and his tunic, wrinkled from travel, straightened until it shone white and clean as a sail. His hair caught the light like buoyant flame. Gasps amongst the men, new cheers burst forth. Thetis, I thought. It could be no one else. She was pulling his divinity forth, mantling it like cream on every inch of his skin, helping her son make the most of his dearly bought fame. I could see the tug of a smile at the corner of his mouth. He was enjoying it, licking the crowd's worship off his lips. He did not know, he told me later, what was happening, but he did not question it. It did not seem strange to him. A pathway had been left open for him, straight through the crowd's heart to where the kings gathered. Each arriving prince was to present himself before his peers and new commander. Now it was Achilles' turn. He strode down the plank and past the jostling ranks of men, stopping perhaps 10 feet from the king's. I was a few paces farther behind. Agamemnon was waiting for us. His nose was curved and sharp like an eagle's beak, and his eyes glittered with a greedy intelligence. He was solid and broad across his chest, firmly planted in his feet. He looked seasoned, but also worn, older than the 40 years we knew him to be. At his right side, a place of honor, stood Odysseus and Diomedes. On his left was his brother, Menelaus, king of Sparta, cause of war. The vivid red hair that I remembered from Tyndareus's hall was touched now with threading gray. Like his brother, he was tall and square, his shoulders strong as a yoke ox. His family's dark eyes and curving nose seemed softer on him, more temperate. His face was smile-lined and handsome, where his brother's was not. The only other king that I could identify with any surety was Nestor, the old man. Chin barely covered by a sparse white beard, eyes sharp in his age-whittled face. He was the oldest man living, it was rumored, the canny survivor of 1,000 scandals and battles and coups. He ruled the sandy strip of Pylos, whose throne he still clutched stubbornly, disappointing dozens of sons who grew old and then older, even as he bred new ones from his famed and well-worn loins. It was two of these sons who held his arms steady now, shouldering other kings aside for a place at the front. As he watched us, his mouth hung open, breath puffing his threadbare beard with excitement. He loved a commotion. Agamemnon stepped forward. He opened his hands in a gesture of welcome and stood regally expectant, waiting for the bows, obeisance, and oaths of loyalty he was owed. It was Achilles' place to kneel and offer them. He did not kneel. He did not call out a greeting to the great king, or incline his head, or offer a gift. He did nothing but stand straight, chin proudly lifted before them all. Agamemnon's jaw tightened. He looked silly like that, with his arms out, and he knew it. My gaze caught on Odysseus and Diomedes. Their eyes were sending sharp messages. Around us, the uneasy silence spread. Men exchanged glances. My hands clutched each other behind my back as I watched Achilles and the game he played. His face seemed cut from stone as he stared his warning at the king of Mycenae. You do not command me. The silence went on and on, painful and breathless, like a singer overreaching to finish a phrase. Then, just as Odysseus moved forward to intervene, Achilles spoke.
I am Achilles, son of Peleus, god-born, best of the Greeks, he said. I have come to bring you victory.
A second of startled silence. Then the men roared their approval. Pride became us. Heroes were never modest. Agamemnon's eyes went flat, and then Odysseus was there, his hand hard on Achilles' shoulder, wrinkling the fabric as his voice smoothed the air.
Agamemnon, lord of men, we have brought the prince Achilles to pledge his allegiance to you.
His look warned Achilles, it is not too late. But Achilles simply smiled and stepped forward so that Odysseus's hand fell off him.
I come freely to offer my aid to your cause, he said loudly.
Then turning to the crowd around him.
I am honored to fight with so many noble warriors of our kingdoms.
Another cheer, loud and long, taking what felt like minutes to die. Finally, from the deep crag of his face, Agamemnon spoke, with patience that had been hard won, hard practiced.
Indeed, I have the finest army in the world, and I welcome you to it. Young prince of Thyre.
His smile cut sharply.
It is a pity you were so slow to come.
There was implication here, but Achilles had no chance to answer. Agamemnon was already speaking again, his voice lifted over us all.
Men of Greece, we have delayed long enough. We leave for Troy tomorrow. Repair to your camps
and make yourselves ready."
Then he turned with finality and strode up the beach. The kings of Agamemnon's innermost circle followed him, dispersing back to their ships, Odysseus, Diomedes, Nestor, Menelaus, more. But others lingered to meet the new hero, Thessalian Eurypylus and Antilochus of Pylos, Meriones of Crete, and the physician Podalirius. Men drawn here for glory or bound by their oath, from every far-flung crag of our countries. Many had been here for months, waiting as the rest of the army straggled together. After such tedium, they said, looking slyly at Achilles, they welcomed any harmless entertainment. Particularly at the expense of...
"Prince Achilles," interrupted Phoenix, "please excuse my intrusion. I thought you would wish to know that your camp is being prepared."
His voice was stiff with disapproval, but here, in front of the others, he would not chide.
"Thank you, worthy Phoenix," Achilles said. "If you'll pardon us."
Yes, yes, of course they would. They'd come by later or tomorrow. They'd bring their best wine and we'd broach it together. Achilles clasped hands with them, promised it would be so. In camp, myrmidons streamed around us hefting baggage and food, poles and canvas. A man in livery approached and bowed, one of Menelaus's heralds. His king could not come in person, he regretted, but had sent the herald here in his place to welcome us. Achilles and I exchanged a glance. This was clever diplomacy. We had not made a friend in his brother, so Menelaus did not come himself. Yet, some welcome was due to the best of the Greeks. "A man who plays both sides of the fence," I whispered to Achilles. "A man who cannot afford to offend me if he wants his wife returned," he whispered back. "Would we accept a tour?" the herald asked. "Yes," we said, in our best princely manner, "we would." The main encampment was a dizzying chaos, a bedlam of motion, the constant fluttering of pennants, laundry on lines, tent walls, the hurrying bodies of thousands and thousands of men. Beyond this was the river, with its old watermark from when the armies had first arrived, a foot higher on the bank. Then the marketplace center, the agora, with its altar and makeshift podium. Last, the latrines, long, open ditches busy with men. Wherever we went, we were observed. I watched Achilles closely, waiting to see if Thetis would again make his hair brighter or his muscles bigger. If she did, I did not notice. All the grace I saw then was his own, simple, unadorned, glorious. He waved to the men who stared at him. He smiled and greeted them as he passed. I heard the words, whispered from behind beards and broken teeth and calloused hands, "Aristos Achaean." Was he as Odysseus and Diomedes had promised? Did they believe those slender limbs could hold against an army of Trojans? Could a boy of 16 really be our greatest warrior? And everywhere, as I watched the questions, I saw also the answers. Yes, they nodded to each other. Yes, yes. Chapter 18. I woke that night gasping. I was sweat-soaked, and the tent felt oppressively warm. Beside me, Achilles slept, his skin as damp as mine. I stepped outside, eager for a breeze off the water. But here, too, the air was heavy and humid. It was quiet, strangely so. I heard no flapping of canvas, no jingle of an unsecured harness. Even the sea was silent, as if the waves had ceased to fall against the shore. Out beyond the breakers, it was flat as a polished bronze mirror. There was no wind, I realized. That was the strangeness. The air that hung around me did not stir, even with the faintest whisper of current. I remember thinking, if it keeps up like this, we won't be able to sail tomorrow. I washed my face, glad of the water's coolness, then returned to Achilles and restless, turning sleep. The next morning is the same. I wake in a pool of sweat, my skin puckered and parched. Gratefully, I gulp the water that Automedon brings us. Achilles wakes, draws a hand over his soaked forehead. He frowns, goes outside, returns.
There is no wind,